So it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker of the conference, Maureen Smith. Maureen Smith received her master's degree in social work from Smith College and worked at several Boston area hospitals in medical, emergency, and psychiatric settings before joining McLean Hospital 20 years ago. At McLean, she's provided family services at all levels of care, working on an inpatient unit as well as triaging admissions to a variety of hospital programs. She currently works in the Personality Disorder Outpatient Clinic and the Borderline Center at McLean Hospital and is on the board of the New England Personality Disorder Association. As a clinician myself who works with patients with borderline personality disorder, I can attest that Maureen is well known, respected, and admired around the McLean community and around Boston for her capacity to meet with highly volatile patients, volatile families, somehow calm the situation, make insightful and pragmatic recommendations that end up helping everybody, patient, family, and the clinicians included. She's going to speak with us on family therapy and interventions. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Maureen Smith.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning. I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you this morning about families, particularly in the context of this conference, which is so focused on these new treatments and therapies for borderline patients. I think it's important that we take a little time out to think about the families of these individuals. And I'm going to be talking, referencing parents. Part of the family I work with tends to be the parents of adult children. And that's probably not surprising. When we get referred people, the parents are usually the last people standing. All the other relationships have kind of been demolished. So because of that enduring bond, most of the people I work with are parents. Everything I'm going to talk about is applicable to other family members, spouses, children. So I think it's it kind of works all the way around. So about 2 years ago, we had a group of clinicians from Ireland come and visit our program. They treated borderline patients and wanted to come and see how we did our program. And they came for about a week, and they visited the partial, the outpatient clinic, attended groups, and our staff meetings and our consultations. And during that week, they came and attended one of my multiple family groups, which I'm going to talk more about. And that's about a 90-minute group. And in that group, I had about five sets of parents, 10 people. And this was about five or six clinicians. They came and sat, and they observed the group. And when we were finished, we asked them if they had any observations or comments. And the first thing they said, they were amazed at the focus, the attention, and the investment in these parents had in their adult children. And one of the clinicians said, you know, we don't have families that are involved. Our patients always say, our families have written us off. They don't care. They're not involved. And we wondered about that together, whether it was cultural issues or economic issues. And then one of the clinicians said, you know, we've never reached out to parents. We have no idea what their experience is. Maybe they would be involved if they had some help or support. So I hope I can do for you what that group did for those clinicians, which is really impress upon you the importance of bringing families into your treatment. So. I'll do this. Worked. So I'm going to start by citing a study by Perry Hoffman, who's here today. I want to give a shout out. Perry Hoffman has probably done more than any other clinician I know to support families and bring them into the fold of treatment, and it's really terrific. So this study that Perry Hoffman and Jill Hooley did about 10 years ago studied expressed emotion. And many of you may know that high expressed emotion, or high EE, has been shown to be a robust predictor of poor clinical outcome in patients with schizophrenia, major depression, bipolar disorder, anorexia, substance alcoholism. And Perry and Jill, and I'll have to ask why, decided to look at this, look at expressed emotion in the families of borderline patients. And they broke the expressed emotion down to hostility, criticism, and emotional over-involvement. And it was very interesting what they found, that both hostility and criticism were not predictors either way of poor or better clinical outcome. However, emotional over-involvement was correlated with fewer hospitalizations and overall improved clinical outcome. Now, that's very significant because it really shows that the more involved families are, the better off patients do. Now, I think about emotional over-involvement as kind of your raw energy. You have to shape that and refine it, and that's a lot of what I'll talk about. So, why do this? Why have family treatment? Well, I jumped ahead there. I just want to say a little bit more. By recognizing and supporting families, you engage that system, that raw energy that I'm talking about, and you also enhance your own understanding of the patient by looking at them in the systems, more of a systems perspective. And then the next slide. If you don't, this is how you will imagine the family system. As we've talked about, patients distort, they have a lot of blaming, they have a lot of negative filters that they see things through, and parents really suffer from this. This slide makes me think about a couple that refer to themselves as Mr. and Mrs. Ogre. And when they came to see me, their daughter had just started in treatment after a volatile course where she had had numerous emergency room admissions and was really in a cycle of doing this. She would call her parents would rush to the emergency room to be greeted by stares, by outright sort of contempt. Staff wouldn't speak to them. They would say, oh, your daughter doesn't allow us to speak to you. And they felt humiliated, devalued, and they didn't know what was going on. The cycle kept going and going. And that experience is not so unusual. Families often feel really criticized by the professionals and often blamed. And it's a source of enormous amount of pain. So when we want to introduce, and I really want to talk about just family work, family treatment, the first thing, of course, is to negotiate boundaries. And I do feel you can do family work even if you're the only clinician on a case, if you're, it's just your individual patient. It's trickier. We have the luxury of having a team approach at McLean. But even as an individual clinician, there are important ways that you might be able to bring a family in, particularly if the family is paying for treatment. It's rather typical when we see patients, I'll talk to families and they have never spoken to a clinician and their family member's been in treatment for years. That's really a mistake. And I'm going to talk a little bit more, but I think there are ways that you can, even if you're alone on a case, have a family be involved periodically. As I said, we use a team approach, which is really lucky because I think it's good for parents to have their own person, you know, their own sort of coach and guide through this, who then collaborates with the patient's therapist. And I think that's really an ideal situation. And then I want to talk about parallel treatments because I really think that the way to go is to give family support and treatment and skills while the patient is getting their support and their skill building. So, parallel treatments, the tasks are very similar for the patient as well as the family. They have similar goals. Also, the idea that parents have their own work decreases this real sense of alienation that I think patients have. People with BPD really know that they throw their family into turmoil. They often feel great shame about it. They may not let you know that, but it can be a real source of suffering. And the fact that you know, patients see that their family too have to learn how to change their behavior through skills, really gives more of a sense of shared purpose and decreases blame. And this idea of collaborating together is kind of a concept that I really want to build on rather than this kind of finger pointing. I also put down here, identify and articulate emotional experience. Parents are particularly prone to denying their own emotional experience, often in an effort to decrease the chaos in the house. I guess the bad habits they get into are their effort to walk on eggshells. I keep saying to them, the book is stop walking on eggshells, you know, so that, you know, their kid will come home and let's say, you know, there's been some untoward event, which is often automobile related in my experience, you know, so they come home, they have another fender bender, you know, they're all, you know, in high emotion, and the parents are like, that's okay, and oh, you're mad, I'm not mad, and this kind of thing is very difficult for borderline patients who are often extremely intuitive. They know when you're mad, and for parents to say they're not, it can be confusing and actually escalate. So one of the really important things is for parents to begin to get in touch with where they are emotionally with all of this. And ultimately, this is all about improving the interpersonal relationships in the family system. So the modalities of treatment, this whole conference is about all these wonderful different treatments for patients. For families, I'm breaking it down into three, and you'll see number one is psychoeducation. And I'm happy to echo both Mary and John on the absolute importance and elegance of psychoeducation in really being that first inroad into helping a family, giving them tools, and bringing down escalation. Patients need it and families need it, sort of this. And understanding personality disorders is very difficult. And also understanding the coexisting conditions, it's bewildering. So it isn't easy, and psychoeducation is a continual process. And I think that's important. It's not like you learn it and it's done. It's always evolving. Skill building, I'm going to go through family guidelines. We have 15 family guidelines that kind of pull from all different areas and are very practical. They touch on mindfulness, validation, and it's a way to kind of get people engaged in treatment. And the last is family therapy. You can only do family therapy when people are more skillful, when emotions are more contained. So, psychoeducation. I love this slide because it captures for me the bewilderment that parents have about their borderline offspring. They really struggle to understand. I also like that the little baby, whatever it is, zebra, has a really angry expression on their face there. But parents don't know what to make of these symptoms. Particularly symptoms like cutting, chronic suicidality, promiscuity, risk-taking, they don't know how to understand it. And actually, they often have their own, they have made assumptions, often very pejorative, about why their family member may do this. And for as many stories as I hear about families who say this patient was difficult from birth, they always had problems, those kinds of things. You will also hear the same amount of stories that my kids seem fine. You know, they did okay. They had a little problem here or there, but in general, they're fine. So all of a sudden, when the bottom falls out in college, you know, we have people who all of a sudden there's a tremendous suicide attempt, and parents are like, where did it come from? And it's only looking back that they piece together what kind of could have contributed. The questions that are raised really need to begin to be looked at in more of an educational approach. So, psychoeducation. This is my best tool for psychoeducation. This is the BPD brief with the emphasis on brief. when I see families, they're really overwhelmed. They don't want to read a book. They can barely get enough sleep. And the speaker debrief has been written by John Gunderson, recently updated, and it addresses the most recent understanding. I want to say these are on the McLean Hospital table outside, so be sure to get one before you go today. John talks about recent research, etiology, treatment, and it really kind of collapses a lot of information in a short space here. And it begins to address this sort of complicated mix of things. Parents always want to know, did I do this, you know? And to begin to sort of wrestle with the reality that it is a very complicated mix of things. Dispelling myths is really important. As we know, people with BPD can do very well in certain areas of their lives. We call this apparent competence. They could do very well academically, vocationally, athletically, and the combination of this, doing really well in one area and then doing extremely poorly interpersonally or socially or even behaviorally in other ways is very hard to understand. And I often see that this is where a lot of the pejorative assumptions come in, and parents are really feeling, is this just a bad kid, a bad character? Everyone throws the word character around in terms of kind of more moral failing. And we want people to move away from judgment and more towards understanding. And really, I think understanding this diagnosis promotes more empathy and less judgment. And it also establishes the groundwork for skills. So, again, more on psychoeducation. It really, I think it's a great way to establish an alliance with the family. The first thing it does is it really counteracts feelings of helplessness and hopelessness, and families are typically awash in this. It gives them something to hold on to, a way to understand the same things that we've heard about patients feeling that sense of relief. It gives a way to kind of get your mind around a lot of chaotic behaviors. And it can begin to sort of instill more hope that this is understandable and that there are things that we can do about it. Even just getting a basic family history can really help counteract that feeling of being devalued and extruded from treatment by kind of saying, you know, we want to know your perspective. We need to know your view of the history, and that by doing that, you really respect the family's role in the recovery of this patient. You really want them to appreciate the fact that you feel that there's a role for them in all of this, and that often has not been done in the past. And again, you know. Begins to help people understand behaviors like cutting, which is revelatory. A lot of families feel like cutting is an attempt for somebody to kill themselves, when often it has a whole different meaning. That I think it really can begin to shift an understanding of things. And we have a lot of different ways to do that, which I'm going to get to, including one-on-one meetings and as well as workshops and different things like that. So actually, that's my next slide. Usually psychoed begins with process of diagnosis or in more of an individual meeting with the family, orienting them to a treatment program. Again, we have the luxury of having people come into our program. I might meet with the family, try to begin to talk about the diagnosis, how we do treatment. But if you were an individual, I know that many of our individual treaters, when they begin with a patient in our program, they'll call the family and say, you know, I want to hear your perspective on things. And I think it's really refreshing to feel that that's a possibility. This has to be negotiated with the patient. You know, a lot of you have to sort of make sure that the patient feels safe about the privacy of their conversations with the therapist, but you know, there are many ways to begin to pull a family in by saying, what do you think about it? What's your view on it? The groups, I think, are really powerful ways of continuing the psychoeducational process because, as I said, it never stops. You have to keep understanding how your family member is sort of, you know, they may decrease really symptomatic behavior, and we see this all the time. The cutting may stop, the suicidality may stop, but then they can't get a job, you know, and you're like, what's you know, the problem here? So groups are really good ways to help push that process along. And groups could be either team, you know, attending a team meeting, a treatment review, which we do regularly. I'm going to talk about the monthly multiple family group, and then we do monthly workshops. In fact, the workshop that we have it the third Thursday of the month, and Randy Krieger came, who wrote Stop Walking on Eggshells. She was at the last workshop to kind of talk about. She has a new book out, which actually I haven't read yet, but looks pretty good. So I want to talk now about skill building. This is also out there on the McLean table. These are the family guidelines. These are fabulous, and I think the reason I like them so much, again, it's a little brief brochure. It gives you the idea of, okay, I can learn what's in here. The guidelines, which are there 15, are very simple but very powerful. And they're skills, which means you have to practice them and get better and better at it. But all of these skills are targeted to help families modify their family environment so that they, again, harness that emotional over-involvement and refine it and kind of make the environment more bearable for somebody with BPD. I don't know if people have used this phrase, but what we talk about a lot is that people with BPD are like born with their skin inside out. You know, they feel everything so profoundly, and you have to really, and that's where, you know, you build on the psychoed, understanding how they experience the world is very different than you do. So that begins to help you see how you might be able to make the home environment a more, you know, soothing kind of place. So there are many skills. I've sort of added down here three others that I think are really important. They're all, I guess, I think really incorporated in these family guidelines. But active listening is really just basic communication skills, I think, are part of what we need to get back to often. And the ability to really sit and listen to what somebody is telling you and not be waiting for your turn or to tell them what you think. Patients with BPD, you often, you know, start to tune them out, especially if you're a parent who's been getting a lot of barraged by a lot of blaming, anger, that kind of thing. But to begin to learn how to really listen and in a respectful way is one of the first things we do. Validation, you know, I always think about my families as the inadvertently invalidating, you know. They have to learn about this. And again, validation is a skill that you start off. It's hard to get. And I see families always, you know, initially, well, you know, I see that's hard for you. And they kind of, that's about all they can do. And then they can kind of move and develop into a more fully validating stance. And then acceptance. I think that is, you know, really important. I think about AA with this, you know, the AA motto, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And for families to kind of know, accept actually their grief in a lot of ways, that their child is not going to sort of be the kid that they thought they were going to be, to begin to sort of grieve and adjust and accept them for what they do have to offer in the lives that they can lead. So trying to sort of sit with it in a mindful way, I think, is really important. So So modality for skill building is, I'm going to talk about the multiple family group, which is a group that's clinician-led. It's a 90-minute group. We try to have no more than six families, and it's typically six couples. It's really terrific when the mother and father both come, husband, wife, mother, father. The function, parents of adult children with this disorder are very alone. I can't stress enough how isolating this can be. They often don't tell their closest friends about what they're going through, and they don't often tell their family members, we just had an overdose and we were in the ER for, they don't tell people that. It's very deeply upsetting, and the group is one place that people talk absolutely openly about all of the horrors that they've been through, and it is absolutely powerful, because sitting with this stuff, the pain that parents have felt, if your kid has tried to kill themselves, is just powerful. And this group is the club that you never wanted to join, but people feel deeply grateful for. I've had about 70 families in my groups, which I have three groups now, and I've been running them for about 8 years. Some people come in for a few months. It works, it's helpful, and they move on. And I have other families that have been in there for years. And I really am deeply grateful to my, because there's one here tonight, of my veteran families who stay in the group and give hope to other people that you can get through this and you can move on. So, express my appreciation for them. So I'm going to go through the skills, because I think they capture everything in many ways. So the first is the first of the counterintuitive parenting, which is part of how you want to instill. Change is difficult to achieve and fraught with fears. Progress evokes fears of abandonment. Be cautious about suggesting that great progress has been made. Avoid you can do it reassurances. This goes against the grain of every parent. You know, when your kid is finally doing okay, you want to become the cheerleader. You want to say, this is fantastic. And Anthony Bateman talked about seeing a patient and saying to the patient, well, you're doing so well. And the patient was like, oh, you don't get it. You know, this is so hard. A patient came in with a, oops. I guess I have to be careful. A patient came in once with the button, the more you do, the more they expect. The idea that moving forward is dangerous. People may think you're okay. They may, totally miss the fact that your life is filled with misery. And they really want you to remember that. So often progress can be followed by sort of more relapse type behaviors. Lower your expectations. You set realistic goals. You solve big problems in small steps. A lot of our patients in the program say, if you say baby step one more time, I'm going to kill you, But it's important for parents, too, to slow them down. They're kind of like, okay, we're going to get back to school, and you're going to have a good life, and it's overwhelming. So just beginning to realize that you just break it down, you do one thing at a time, and really works amazingly well. Family environment, keep things cool. We don't want a lot of high EE, we want people to be involved and care, but we want to keep things cool and calm. And John is always good at encouraging people, tone everything down. You want to tone down a lot of appreciation, and you want to tone down disagreement. You want to bring everything to a more neutral kind of zone. Maintain family routines. I love this one. I was recently talking to a family right before Christmas, and their daughter had started in our program. She had had a number of starts and stops, and she started and she was doing well. She was going to go home for Christmas. And we were on the phone planning how the vacation was going to go, and they were like, you know, well, what should we, you know, talk about? Should we, you know, try to, you know, support all of these goals that you made? I said, listen, be superficial. You're on, you know, your Christmas vacation. And they were like, oh, thank God, we don't have to talk about treatment. We don't have to do any of this. You just have to have your family routines. And they were enormously relieved. We also did some problem solving around this patient because every family holiday had been disastrous up to that point. So we did some strategizing about how to help her get through it and what was realistic. And they kept everything light and neutral, and they had a very successful visit. So impressing upon families that even in the presence of a lot of crisis and difficult behavior, that you do want to keep family routines, and you do want to find ways to connect and put all of that stuff aside. Find time to talk. I know a lot of parents are like, oh my God, no more talking, please. I have a mother and daughter who really capture this. She is very needy, very demanding, very symptomatic, and very connected to her mother, calling her 1,000 times a day. And the mother is just besieged, so I'm working with the mother on setting limits. The therapist is working with the patient on trying to control her dependency. And the therapist and I talked, and what we proposed is that this mother and daughter had tea once a week. And the mother says to me, my God, not another thing. I have no time to my life. I said, well, let's just try to do this, that you're going to have tea, a mother-daughter tea, which they had had in the past when she was little and they liked a lot. So they did this. They had their once-a-week tea, which they scheduled, and they talked about movies, theater, you know, shopping. And it actually helped, which was what our hope was, decrease the other kind of very sort of demanding behavior on this daughter, knowing that she had this time with her mother, which is really what she wanted, but she was going about it the wrong way, it was very successful. And it actually, the mother ended up feeling a lot more relief, and it worked out well. And if you have to schedule that, you do. Managing crisis, pay attention, but stay calm. A lot of parents, what they do is they're either in the middle of it or they try to pretend they don't see it. You have to sort of find a way to deal with this. This number six is one of the toughest ones for parents and for many of us who can be defensive. Don't get defensive in the face of accusations and criticism. However unfair, say little and don't fight. Allow yourself to be hurt and admit to whatever is true in the criticism. We call it finding the nugget of gold in the bucket of sand. This is counterintuitive. Every parent I know wants to say, well, this is why I'm doing this. They want to explain themselves to their family member, and it only escalates. It does not diminish. And parents don't even realize they're being defensive. They think it's really natural to say, well, this is why I'm doing it, because I love you, because this is going to help you. It actually doesn't work. So you have to kind of take a leap of faith to do this one, because parents feel, if I agree with anything they're saying, all hell's going to break loose. But actually, you know, if you can say, you know, you're getting all this criticism, you don't do this, you don't listen, you don't do that. Well, actually, you know, I was really distracted when you were talking to me, and I wasn't really listening. And when people start to do this, start to see where they can agree with the person, and there's usually something to it, because again, these patients are very intuitive. Parents always say, you know, that boy, they know right where to get me, you know. So if you can just speak to what's true in it, it will bring down the kind of you know, sort of barrage. But you don't know that till you try it, because again, it feels counterintuitive. But the minute you do that, the patient is like, oh, okay, you get this, you know, and they don't have to keep doing more to try to convince you. They actually connect. Self-destructive acts or threats require attention. Don't ignore, but don't panic. This is really references. I have a lot of families who deal with cutting. And some patients cut in private and in secret, and others do it very dramatically. And how to responding when there's a lot of blood around is really hard for anybody, but if it's your kid, it's even harder. So you want to respond to this kind of behavior, but you don't want to panic. You want to talk about it openly. You want to come to a strategy about it, and you want to make sure that professionals know about these kinds of things. 8 is listen. Again, I kind of go back to that active listening. This, again, is really hard for parents because the guideline goes on to say people need to have their negative feelings heard. Don't say it isn't so. Don't try to make feelings go away. Using words to express fear, loneliness, inadequacy, anger is good. It's better to use words than to act out. It's enormously difficult for parents to hear their kids say, I want to die. Life isn't worth living. How do you respond to that? People are saying, how do you validate that? You know, well, people get skillful and can. And one way is just to listen and to be able to say, I can bear hearing what you're telling me. Because again, that sense of aloneness that patients have, it's very hard to do. Parents want to say, oh, but you have your whole life ahead of you, or, you know, you're a beautiful young girl, you know. And it is the absolute wrong thing to do. People feel even more alone and more desperate. But it isn't easy to do that. And that's, again, where I think in my group, when people are in a group together with other parents and can share how hard it is to do that stuff. But when you do it, there is basically a connection made. And that's really what you're always going for, is how to have patients stay connected to their families and not alone. Addressing problems, collaborate and be consistent. And that's another issue. Parents have often gone into problem-solving mode, advice-giving, rescuing, all these sorts of things. The idea that there's a problem and you first involve the family member in the problem sometimes is a new idea. Because patients may get into this mode of kind of throwing their hands up. And the idea of like, okay, let's think about it. I'm not going to leave you alone with it, but I'm not going to solve it for you, can be harder than you think, especially when people create messes, when they get arrested, when they, you know, have legal charges, things like this. You really want to pull them in and keep saying, this is your life, I'm going to be there for you, but how do you think we should move forward? Resist that advice giving and telling people what they should do. And that's very hard for a lot of families. And sometimes patients have, you see through their lives that there have been difficulties that have been there but have been more subtle, that parents have kind of gone in and shored up and helped. And so there really becomes a pattern. Number 10 is a big one. Family members need to act in concert with one another. Parental inconsistencies fuel severe conflicts. And I think that's one of the first things that we really focus on. Parents get polarized. We know borderlines, people with borderline personality disorder split. They will work one parent against the other. There's often, it's somewhat falls along gender lines. There's the father who sometimes is the bad cop and the mother's the good cop, and sometimes it's the other way around. But there's usually a parent that's more limit setting and then a parent that's more, you know, nurturing. And then, but that gets polarized in a very dangerous way, because then the parents are fighting with each other. And I see this all the time. If you did this, she wouldn't have done that. If you did that because you were like that to her, this is what happened. And then the parents are alone. I mean, and the marriage is strained. So you want to shore up the family, the marriage in particular, if you have two parents, to kind of come together and support each other. Sort of like, you know, the first thing you do is you take care of yourself, then you take care of your spouse, and then you keep your family system in this sort of way. And then the last one, if you have concerns about medications or therapist intervention, make sure that you talk to the patient, and you know, if you need to let the therapist know, you should know. It's especially if you have financial responsibility. A lot of the times, what I say to parents is, you know, you have the right to leave a message with your, you know, your son or daughter's therapist. Therapists may not call you back, they may not want to directly speak with you, but if you have a deep concern, you can do that. The therapist will then tell your son or daughter that they called, but when safety is an issue and medications are an issue, you have to I always say to parents, you know, you have to go with your gut. If you feel unsafe or frightened or scared about something, you need to do what feels right to you. So, limit setting is a great one. And I love this guideline because limit setting is so hard to know where to set limits. We often talk about when do you step forward, when do you step back. And this guideline says you set limits by stating the limits of your tolerance. And I think this is so good. It goes back to you really have to know where you're at with things. And there's not a blueprint for this. Every family has a different level of what they can tolerate. Let your expectations be known in clear and simple language. Everyone needs to know what's expected of them. And this is another thing, I think probably one of the things we spend the most time with in the group is kind of where do you set that line? And it's very important to do it when you can hold that line. Sort of we get down to number 15, but the reason you have to set the limit based on your tolerance is you really have to feel authentic and right about the limit so you can hold it and know that it makes sense to you. Don't protect family members from the natural consequences of their actions. This is often, hard to know when to do this. There's a lot of families that bail people out of jail all the time, pay credit card debt, do a lot of mop-up. And at some point, it may make a lot of sense to start to let people bump up against these consequences where obviously they need to be able to do it in a certain way. And sometimes it's good to kind of do this by having them manage small consequences and move on to larger ones. But it's really important. And it also gives the implicit message that, you're in charge of your life, and we expect that you have to follow up with this. Don't tolerate abusive treatment. We don't have a lot of people, yes, tantrums, yes, threats. Not so much hitting and spitting, but it happens. The idea that you really need to walk away. I've had family members, they go lock themselves in the bathroom, they're yelling through the bathroom door, but you really want to set limits on this. It's amazing how many people have allowed this to go too far, have really really abused. There was a mother in our group, a new parent in one of my groups, and I was going to talk about this later, but I'm going to bring it in here now. Their daughter is very angry and aggressive and can have really explosive outbursts. They've had to call the police a number of times. She's doing a little bit better, and there hadn't been this hadn't happened in a while. And the daughter who lives at home wanted to go back to college. This is another thing. People go through pay lots of money for tuition for folks like this because they start and they stop and they start and they stop. So she wanted to go back to school, had a discussion with her father, who basically said, this is what I'm going to pay for. This is my limit. I can't pay for anymore. She became furious with him. He knew enough to not, because he had exploded in the past. He's come along and sort of got to the point where he knew he needed to leave the room because he would otherwise fight with her. He left and went up to the bedroom, shut the door, and she turned on the mom. And the mom has not learned enough about how she can sort of protect herself. She got her mother in the family room, and the patient, who's rather large, blocked the door so the mother couldn't leave. She sat down in the chair and she said, I just sat there, and her daughter stood over her, she said, for 2.5 hours, screaming in her face, there's this, and there's this, and you haven't done this, and you never do this for me. She was afraid to get up because she was afraid her daughter might hit her. She didn't want to call 911 because she thought that would get her daughter angry. So at one point, her daughter backs off and picks up this big pillar candle. And the mother says to her, "You're not going to throw that at me, are you?" She tells us this in the group, and everyone goes, "You didn't say that, you know." And we sort of talked about that would be an example of put the candle down, you know. That really there was an escalation that she was contributing to, even suggesting that she was going to throw it. And people don't see that. And when you start to deconstruct that and we kind of unpack these situations in the group, and everybody in the group could empathize how bad it was, but we really used the group to strategize. You do not sit in a chair and let someone rant for 2.5 hours. It is overstimulating. It's not good for you. It's not good for her. And you really use your language to calm things down. So the last one is be cautious about issuing threats or ultimatums. And this is a big one. People do ultimatums all the time. They have no intentions of carrying out. So they really need to do that. I'm going to quickly go through Mr. Z because I think he really captures how the group can really help people. And it's such a typical example. Their daughter seemed to do well. She's very beautiful girl, very accomplished athletically, and then went to college and crashed, had a near-lethal overdose. And this was one of these sets of parents that were like, what happened? He was furious. And as we looked at her behavior over time, there was a lot of dependency, a lot of inadequacies that she had covered up that were really just sort of all came out. This dad was a businessman, very successful, and he was enraged with his daughter. She's a liar. He had all of these assumptions about why she behaved the way she did. He was telling her what to do. She had a very difficult course. She came to the hospital. She was diagnosed with BPD. She was put on an antidepressant. She became manic. She was quite psychotic. She was basically in our hospital in one level or another for over a year. And it was very deeply upsetting, especially when she was psychotic. He basically was challenging to every professional. John probably doesn't remember. He even said, "How does John Gunderson think she has BPD? How can he say that?" He didn't believe anyone. He was very hard to even sit with. I met with them separately, and we had maybe one or two meetings with the daughter, but it was clear to me right from the start. He was so critical of her. It was really toxic for her at the time. He came to the group, and what happened, they've been in the group for almost 3 years, and I think the group really helped him find a place to express his anger at his daughter, at the professionals. The group really understood where he was coming from. And he got from the group the compassion that he was really struggling with. His wife had all the compassion. She kind of counteracted him. And he was really able in that group to move from the one side to the other, which I think is so critical, that he moved from this sort of angry and very rejecting of his daughter to accepting. And that was through psychoeducation. He didn't really approve of a lot of things, but he began to accept them. He stopped giving advice, which was really important because she couldn't do any of the stuff he was saying, and really began to respect that she had to find her own way through this. And again, this is through the group and kind of seeing other parents struggle with their kids. He went from sort of angry and detached, to more neutral and available. So she called him once a month. He wouldn't say to her, "Why haven't you called me in a month?" He'd say, "Well, it's good to hear from you." You know, he's sort of able to realize that that was the way to respond. And this critical blaming, he moved towards that more benign interpretation. "Well, she was an hour late to come and visit us for dinner." "Well, maybe, you know, it's hard for her to get going." Where before he would, "She's thoughtless, she's, you know, all of this." This really jumped out at me when we had a new family come into that group and a father came in who was very angry and sort of critical of professionals, family member. And this dad said, "Hey, listen, it's okay. I was where you were. You know, you're going to see that this group is going to help you." He said, "If I hadn't been in this group, I wouldn't have a relationship with my daughter." And it kind of hit me that, yeah, you know, it really was powerful. So this is my family therapy slide. I think this is an actual photograph of one of my family therapy sessions. My point is, you can't do family therapy unless people are skillful. It is just too difficult, and it isn't really productive. Family therapy requires the psychoeducational sort of background. It requires good communication skills. You need a therapeutic alliance with a clinician to feel that somebody's going to help you through this, and a recognition of validation and an ability to do that. It's really important. Parents have to be able to listen. Patients have to be able to listen. I really want you to go away from this thinking about family work and not family therapy. You know, people have had, you know, traumatic experiences with family therapy. And again, it's not the be-all and end-all. It's a way to work with the family, and that can be as little as a participation every few months in a team meeting. Administrative meetings, which are often the beginning, that sort of gateway to family therapy. There's nothing like talking about finances to bring up dynamics in a family, but we often have to deal with housing, transportation, stuff like that. And then down the line, sort of traditional family therapy. But that's sort of, you have to come to that more naturally. So this is my anti-family therapy slide. This is a tree of harmony. You can tell it's harmony because it has rainbows and birds and things like that. But the idea that people are working together and with a shared purpose. I often say to families, it's some Buddhist, you know, fundamental that all of life is harmony moving to disharmony, and then you move to repair, back to harmony, back to disharmony, back to repair. We live in the repair part of all of this, and it is really profoundly important to have the ability to move through this cycle, because we never stay in the harmony part. And then, just finally, this is in your packet, in your folder, but these are resources for families. The Connections Program, Perry Hoffman is here. She and Alan Frizzetti started. This is a curriculum-based 13-week program. Do I have the right site on that? Good, okay. And it's terrific, and Perry has really gotten this going so that parents run these groups, and that we're hoping that they can kind of disseminate throughout the country, actually. The New England Personality Disorder, which is our sort of local branch of family support. The NEABPD, which is terrific, and I think is taping this. It does a lot of conferences, and you can get online. And the BPD Resource Center, which is, again, a great resource for families. I mean, they have, I think, a database of DBT clinicians around the country, so you can find treaters. And today we have a representative from TARA, who TARA is a family support organization that started in New York. And we have, and I'm going to, Lena Newcomb, who was doing a chapter out in California, who's moved back to Massachusetts. And I think there are flyers on your table. She does a monthly family support group in the Northampton area. So, thank you.
I think we have time for maybe one or two questions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Hi. I work with adolescents, and often when I have a borderline personality disorder adolescent, it's not unusual to go and have an untreated personality disorder parent. And when there's a crisis, this is, I find it's a very difficult situation. Any suggestions?
Well, my suggestion is that the parent needs support. And needs to have, I mean, it's actually a really good way to sort of say, there's a lot of my parents, I say, you know, you need your own therapist to sort of help you through this. So it can actually, especially if it's a parent who's had an untreated personality disorder, it may be a way to actually introduce treatment in a more, let's help you learn how to help your daughter and kind of make an inroad. So it actually may really be an opportunity. Because even the best adjusted parent really needs support and coaching through these kinds of crises. For treating the parents of young children, or? Well, at McLean we have an adolescent program and a child program, so you know, I think that would be a place to start. Okay, thank you all very much.